Hello. In this episode of Airs for Architecture, architect, researcher, educator and curator Lawrence Lord speaks about his practice, AP&E, or Architecture Practice and Experimentation, which he founded with Geoffrey Bullhouse and which operates out of Ireland and Holland. We speak about his journey to practice, his recent work on the 2023 Venice Biennale, and ideas of the civic, the public and the social in his work.
Airs for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Airs for Architecture. I'm talking today to Lawrence Lord. Lawrence, would you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, Ambrose. Fantastic to be here. So my name is Lawrence Lord. I'm an Irish architect. I'm based in Cavan in County Ireland. I'm in practice with a Dutch architect based in Amsterdam, Geoffrey Bullhouse. Our office is AP&E. We're quite a small office, but that's the ambition. We're very much interested in the social and the cultural value of architecture. We would do a lot of work in terms of exhibition making, exhibition design, and community-led master plans. And the way we operate, I suppose, which is maybe slightly different to others, is very much through the notion of collaborative practice. We work with other specialists, other architects or economists or different thinkers on a number of different projects, both in the Netherlands and in Ireland, and then we've done a bit of work in terms of with the Venice Biennale over the years, and I guess that's possibly something that we'll loop back to.
Yeah, for sure.
As a part of this conversation. Yep.
Yeah, no. So where did you train? Where were you trained at?
Oh right, so I trained in Dublin. I trained in what was Bolton Street, then I think it was DIT, and now it's TU Dublin. I would have trained there in the late 90s, emerging right at the peak, just before it crested, of the Celtic Tiger. So I would have come out of college in 2006. I also studied in Copenhagen for a year, studied in the Royal Academy of Fine Arts in Copenhagen for a year as well. So that's where I trained. And then myself and Jeff, we would have met in effectively the first offices that we would have worked in post-graduation. So I worked in an office called FKL in Dublin. And Paul Kelly would have been my tutor in DIT. And the enticement was they were doing the Irish Pavilion at the Venice Biennale that year, Suburban Super Rural, which was a group show. I think there was 9 different practices that were all doing very interesting things at the time. But and there was a lot of money floating around in the Irish economy. And I went to work for them for a number of years before it all came crashing down around us and we all left. So that was kind of, that's where we started practice. And then that actually, funny enough, it's upon reflection on that particular show, that National Pavilion, that's kind of been something that's been kind of a touchstone to us in terms of the work that was output for that, for in terms of the types of practice that we've been involved in ever since.
So, that's a really interesting moment. I was working in practice when the economic crash happened as well, and it was just it was a sort of remarkable day that turned into a remarkable permanent reality. Our work dried up almost overnight. What was it like in Ireland? Because it was even more extreme then.
Yeah, it certainly was. So it was, in a peculiar way, actually, I think its impact I still kind of hold, and I would suggest that its impact in terms of being staff is part of the reason that we actively try and not have staff, lots of staff. So it was very quick when it happened. I and my then girlfriend, now wife, we actually went to London pretty instantly. Actually, I managed to secure work, and she was still a student, and she secured work quickly as well. So we went to London for 5 years. That was kind of the holding pattern that emerged out of that, and that happened to lots of different things. And then as a result of that sort of not having to worry about what fancy door handles you're going to specify, and all these various issues, it started a conversation thinking about sort of the broader ideas of what architecture is, or different ways to practice, because there was very little money, and trying to find different ways of operating and having a critical insight about operating, so that the response wasn't always how and what we build, but it's actually how and what we think about, and sort of pursuing different terms of spatial practice and different terms of the built environment, which is kind of useful. So in terms of all these things, all good things come to an end. We had a very I personally had a very limited exposure to it in terms of that type of practice, in terms of very, very busy, high demand for architects, developer led, build more expensively, build higher. I had very little exposure to that. And then I think Ireland then, particularly where I was based in Dublin, would have then had a sort of a had a period of reckoning and a period of drying out, and then a period of understanding actually what is this really about, and then trying to understand.
But you say what you said at the beginning there with your practice, you and you mentioned specifically economists, that you work alongside communities, so on, and economists. Has that collaboration with economists been in part inspired by that experience, or even if only peripheral, that it kind of a sense that architecture needs to be an enterprise that understands the economization of its own practices?
Well, if I'm brutally frank, I wouldn't have sort of seen that crossover. I would suggest though that the people that we're working with in terms of understanding business, understanding local economy, are also very they understand policy as well. And then particularly for some of the work that we're looking at in Ireland at the minute, which is about building up community, understanding social capital, and also understanding funding streams and understanding how things change and how things happen. We have a certain spatial understanding, which is super and all, but is also quite is only one particular direction. So then for us to bring and work with people that can think in terms of, well, if you were to do that, this is how you might actually ultimately pay for it, or this is the strategy you might go about to build that up, rather than the metrics that we have as where we'll do a design and people will love the design and we'll submit for planning and then it'll be built. It's actually building it up in a slightly different way and building capacity with local communities and then trying to get engagement with local authorities. That's part of the work that we do at the minute, which is also, I completely understand that there's a slight difference then in that in terms of the idea of exhibition making, but in a peculiar way, we kind of land all those things in the same space, that it's about advocating for and discussing and providing a framework where things can happen, necessarily being just solution driven, but being also moving past the realm of what I guess what the idea of traditional architecture is about, in just in broader sense.
How does that work? I mean, just as in practical terms, how does that work as an architectural designer? Because I don't know if in Ireland the fee structure is exactly the same as it is in the UK, but I s assume it's more or less the same. How does it work when you're doing community-based work at the initiation of projects in terms of sort of funding practice? How does one economize that? Because as someone said a while back to me, activism, in fact, they were talking about the Venice Biennale. No one pays for activists. There's no money in being an activist. So, and I often think that community-based architecture or community-led architecture has that quality of activism about it, which is very difficult to fee for. How does AP&E
How do we do
work
that?
with it? Yeah, I mean, without revealing trade secrets and
I don't think, yeah, I don't think it's much of a trade secret, but it's, yeah. Okay. Well, I suppose let me contextualize this. Okay. So just to sort of give a little bit of background to what I'm describing. So the work that we're doing both in the Netherlands, but what I'm going to speak about is predominantly my experience, which is in Ireland, which is has all by way emerged from a project that we did at the Venice Biennale in 2018. So 2018, as I'm sure you're well aware, was kind of the counterpoint to the 2008 Celtic Tiger crash. It was for particularly for Irish architects. So the overall creator of the show was Von Farrell, Shelley McNamara. First time Irish curators ever for either art or architecture. There was lots of Irish participants as part of some of the special projects that they were running. And then a bunch of us, architects and academics, came together and made a pitch for the Irish Pavilion. And our pitch was based around, it's called Free Market, and it was based around market spaces in rural towns across Ireland. These kind of originally areas that were designed with a lot of love and intent and idea of congregation and gathering and, and trade. And now we're much aligned in terms of high vacancy levels in these towns. No one necessarily wanted to live in the town or village centres. People were pushing to the edge. So you had this repeated story up and down the country in terms of these derelict market spaces, and they were full of car parks, and they weren't loved, and all of this. So this was something that was quite interesting to us. We pitched this, and then we were fortunate enough then to be selected, and were the national was the Irish National Pavilion for that year, which is great because it was huge exposure for us. We were delightfully out of our depth, and therefore gave everything. So that's a team of six of us, Free Market. So that's Tara Kennedy, Miriam Delaney, Orla Murphy, Joanne Butler, Jeffrey, and I. We came together to work on that. So it's a collaborative project. As a result of that, and then as a result of the tour that you're obliged to do in Ireland next year, where we went to these market spaces, external exhibition market spaces across the country. And a lot of work, a lot of people were doing at the time, a lot of different agencies. There was a policy shift in Ireland. So it was a policy shift that was a town centre first plan. There was a change at higher level in government, and there was also looking to our neighbours in Scotland in terms of a policy that was designed to preserve town cores, find ways to combat dereliction, find ways to combat vacancy, find ways to reevaluate what our public realm was in those spaces. And then these are the types of projects that have kind of the last few years, a number of us are still working together. So Miriam, Tara, Jeff, and I, and others, we are working on these types of projects. So you might, from the outside, you might be able to describe it as activism, but actually it's actually practice. So in a lot of these cases, we're working with communities that have approached us. So community groups, combinations of community groups, new town teams. And then we develop ideas, both initially spatial, because that was our area of understanding. Well, you could have this, you could have this. But then finally, after that, sort of understanding that there's soft policy as well. There's different elements that there's projects that involve how people can learn elements together, how you can make a town or a village more accessible. So it's not just about super slick public realm and street lighting and seating and living above the shop. It's about more elements that are feeding into that. So and then as a result of this, these projects are ongoing. And now the local authorities can see that there's a gathering of these ideas, and then there's funding for these types of projects. So like we're one of many, many architects, spatial practitioners that are working in this field now. And for us, it's for us then working with different people that don't just think the same way as us. It's kind of super because you understand more about what you're actually dealing with and what the issues are, and then slowly accepting that architecture isn't the cure for these types of issues. It's one of many things that has to work
Yeah.
side.
It's a very interesting idea, the strength of that collaborative practice. And I did look at that 2018 Biennale Free Market pavilion that you did, and very elegant it was too. It's a kind of fascinating story. So the idea that you're promoting, and perhaps this is where the split with the kind of around the millennium, that kind of very glossy form of architecture, slightly playful, if by playing you mean, like a funfair, really lurid and kind of insane. This is a much more an approach which tries to appropriate, not appropriate, perhaps enhance normative ways of dwelling in these places. So how do you go about digging into that? How do you find this? Like, what do I mean, as a spatial practitioner, how do you approach this?
Well, I can only really speak for AP&E, so with Jeff and I. So for us, And this has been, obviously, Amro's like ridiculously post-rationalized, but for us, we're very interested in the idea of publicness and public space and whatever that means. The opportunity of doing big civic building hasn't presented itself to us, and we kind of haven't necessarily pursued it as well. The sort of the social value and the cultural value of architecture is particularly interesting. So even in like the tiniest projects we've done, which may not have lasted particularly long, but the idea of how they can enable or they facilitate people coming together in any way, shape, or form, whether it's educational, whether it's in a museum setting, whether it's in a public realm. So exhibition works or even different components like that, they're particularly interesting to us. And that's something that we're very drawn to, and different ways of that happening across different scales and also across different levels of involvement. So in some cases, we've only had the initial involvement in these types of projects, and then through procurement process and tendering and turnover and whatnot, these things move on to other architects and designers. And that's kind of okay as well. And then that's always kind of our starting point. So it's trying to find projects that enable that. We're also particularly interested in the idea of latency and potential spaces and building upon others. And also, don't know, but also in a weird way, the sort of the dissolution of authorship as well. The idea that authorship is shared. And so it is actually working with people. Collaboration really is just about working with people that are smarter than you and bringing people on board that can do things that you can't. So we're not particularly interested in the top-down notion. It's kind of working, it's working across and working with people that we want to work with. So we kind of constantly do that. And so if you look through the projects that we do, we're working with lots and lots of different people, both in Ireland and the Netherlands, that our colleagues and friends, and they offer something that we they offer avenues and ways of thinking that we don't always offer. That's kind of the joy. So you learn from those, and then you grow and you grow and you grow.
I think that's an important thing that perhaps has emerged. I mean, yeah, my experience again wasn't peripheral to that crash, but saw the outcome of it and then saw these new types of practices where the role of the architect is somewhat, I suppose one might see it as unseated from their preeminent position, that authored thing. And perhaps we can get on to the Venice Biennale in a bit, but one of the things that I've noticed, and your website sort of documents a number of your projects in both in Holland and in Ireland, where there's a strong emphasis around this word of the commons or commoning. What does this word mean? In your work, what does it mean to you, I suppose? How are you interpreting this idea of the commons? Obviously, there's this historical idea of the commons, the medieval commons, which is sort of deconstructed through the Reformation, according to Marx, or and various other theorists. What does it mean now? What does it mean in your work?
What it means to us. Well, there's a couple of you'll notice all the terms commoning, they're all the kind of the Dutch projects. So Jeff has kind of come to title those. It's interesting when you
Well,
mentioned
maybe that's an interesting question, actually, that we could come to is like, what is the difference between these two contexts that you're working in and working out how you create a practice that works across two very distinct geographical areas? But maybe we can come back to that.
if you can
Maybe it's just a rhetorical difference. I didn't
Well, I think, yeah, if you can help us with that, that'd be super.
know.
It'll save us a PhD. I guess the first project there where it came up as a term was Project Vandenberg Commons, and that was a project we did in Haarlem in a peculiar way. And I'm sure this might sound peculiar to others, but We equate this particular part of Harlem, which is the Schalkwijk, which is a post-war neighborhood on the edge of the city. We can see a lot of similarities in that, and then the types of villages and towns that we look at in the Irish countryside, just in terms of density, proximity to major cities, how communities are built up, how people live, all those types of things. So for us, there's a that's kind of a Dutch version of events, and then there's the Irish version of events that we're looking at, which is much more, I guess, bucolic and closer to agriculture. But then there's the Dutch context. So Vattenburg Commons was a, it was a it was like the way I see it, it's kind of it was this panorama locale architecture competition that we managed to win. And then panorama locale is kind of it's it'd be similar enough to Europan in that sense that you would win a competition. There's intent for it, and it's kind of particular types of practices that they're trying to support. So it's municipality led. And we they wanted to I can't, I think the numbers is there was 14 of these housing blocks that they wanted to get rid of. And then tabula rasa, start again, build up a new neighborhood on this. And we were particularly interested in that in terms of working with local communities, building up relationships that way. And then also the idea of redeveloping the existing. So we made a proposal that maybe not all would get knocked down, and where they do get knocked down, we're trying to hold on to the fabric that's there in the sense of the building frames, and hold on to the roads, and hold on to how the community has been built, or then converting existing into sort of educational or more community-based uses, and then adapting the existing residential blocks that they can, be more suited out for the future. So this was the kind of the idea of, and I know you've spoken about it a lot actually on the podcast because I listened back in terms of the notion of permaculture, or the notion of this permaculture urbanism. So it's existing social and then the urban fabric that we're particularly interested in. And that's a kind of a project that's kind of gone on in terms of working with the local authorities, working with the city, but predominantly working with them with these local community groups and then developing that. So that's and then also as part of that, or development, I suppose, from that is this notion of contemporary commoning. That was a project that it was a research project that we or well Jeff principally did with the Rietveld Academy, VAC, and René Boer, where small lightweight pieces of furniture were developed that could then be that were mobile. That were kind of set into the wild. They were in Dutch, they were called, and I apologize to any Dutch listeners, wiele matches, but we like the term wheelie mates. That could be seats, could be goalposts, could be stages, could be platforms, and they were and then the easy to move. They're on wheels, and they were set out into the wild, into this island of Zeeburger Island, where there was public realm, but it wasn't really being used. It had been identified that it was kind of there was a lot of potential there, but no one was really taking ownership or taking space as you would get as you get throughout the rest of Amsterdam. And this was to initiate a dialogue. It was a sort of this idea of collective ownership, commoning space, commoning these elements, and different things that can emerge from that. I should point out, sorry, that that first project that I talked about, Vattenburg Commons, which was the master plan, we did that with Studio De Mau. So Daryl Mulvihill, an Irish architect, and also at VAC. So it's those types of ideas in terms of looking at a master plan from a sort of a holistic and a social level, and then also looking at master plans that have happened and then their failings in terms of the public realm. And is there something playful or something low cost and lightweight and low on resources that we can initiate to start different things that might have emerged out of that? And again, it's like all these things. It's like when we step away from the strategy, particularly with the wheelie mates, when we step away from that, what can that become? And how does that get used? So there's a series of photographs on our website of these kind of quite lonely little galvanized steel frames just kind of sitting in the wilderness on this island. But actually it's the other ones where, they've been used as goalposts, or they've been used as stages, or they've been used as TikTok videos, or they've been used for a whole plethora of different elements. That's really interesting, because then we've zero involvement at that point. It's stepped away. So it's someone else's. And then it becomes about the public.
Yeah. And that organic, that natural organic process of the commons, and maybe this goes back to this idea of the market, the marketplace, which obviously, as you said, your free market work in 2018 at the Biennale. I wonder how you find it working. So these rural towns, these Irish rural towns, are largely unauthored. There may have been architects of some description involved in their emergence over the centuries, but they're not what we might describe as designed environments in a kind of intentional, designerly sort of way. I guess this is where I've always struggled with this idea of commoning in architecture, although I've been very fond of it and very interested in it myself. Is it really possible for these practices, these design practices that emerge out of professional knowledge, architectural professional knowledge, is it really possible for us to replicate meaningfully those organic commoning practices of the marketplace, of the street, of the small piece of infrastructure? Is this a kind of new thing, or and is this why it works best at the scale that you're talking about, these small interventions? Is it possible to scale that up, that idea up?
I think that's a very interesting notion, I suppose. There's a few things. So firstly, I would suggest that the towns, whether they're top-down designed in terms of as a master plan where, you've produced renders. No, of course they're not designed that way, but there's certainly with a lot of the towns that we identified, particularly their morphology over time, there's a town, the town that I'm in now, like less than half a kilometer from here, is there's 300 meters of very, very straight terrace, and it's 40 meters wide, and it continues like that. One of the towns we looked at, Temple Moor, is also an equivalent. So there's the idea of frontality and a spatial quality, and you get these diamond towns or others where the roads simply meet. But then there's been the work around that is iterative, but it's the fact that, I guess, maybe the question is about design, is that it's multi-authored, mm-hmm. and it happens over time and it evolves. But I'd still say there's always a design intent to that. In terms of scaling up, I don't know. I can't really answer that. But I do know that there's something that we keep recurring in a lot of the work that we're looking at in terms of suburbs, post-war housing in the Netherlands, or also towns and villages in Ireland. And that is kind of this, just a simple notion of shelter, just really, really simple ideas in terms of creating a space where that happens. There's a reference point for that, where there's this market there's a town in Town County Leash in Ireland, Strathbally, and there's this very simple market frame. It's quite small, like it's like 12 meters by 6 or something like that. And all it does is it keeps the rain off you and offers you somewhere to sit. And even that in its simplest form, I think, carries a lot of value. So just from a spatial practitioner perspective, or someone that, puts buildings together and worries about rain, that is an element in terms of scaling up. I'm not so sure how straightforward that is. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of useful to us. I also think that the idea of scaling up is not always so interesting as well. I think there's a level in terms of intervention and involvement that at the minute, like, things might change, but at the minute we're particularly interested in. So it's, for us, it's not necessarily about bigger and more and better. It's trying to find our successes within that.
But I mean, the project that you've got in Carlo in Skyfold.
Oh, yeah.
That's being built?
Oh, that's done. No. I mean,
I was going to say, if they're renders, they're the best bloody renders I've ever seen.
No. I mean, that was a short-term intervention. That was with good friend of the office, Emmett Scanlon.
Yeah.
We worked with Emmett on that. That was post COVID. That's an existing building. Uh-huh. So that's us having fun with film.
Who was the architect for that originally?
Oh,
Chipperfield?
No, sorry, it's going to come to me now. English architect. Give me a sec.
Google, where are you when we need you?
Yeah.
We used to have something called memories.
Terry Pawson.
Who?
Terry Pawson.
Terry Pawson. No relation to John.
No. Maybe I can't.
I don't know.
Not that I'm aware of. I don't know if that's on either of their Wikipedia pages.
It's quite an interesting idea that you get a very you take on a piece of very formal, high end, super authored, impositional, top down architecture in a place like Carlo, and then to make it work in relation to the kind of post-COVID context, you intervene in this very precise way.
Well, yeah, the strategy was really simple. Post-COVID, our lockdown restrictions were quite severe, and it was trying to find there's a space of shelter at the entrance to it. And in the past, people had congregated there, and the move was to try and bring people to that and offer seating, where people could emerge from lockdown and congregate safely and talk. But that was a temporary installation, so that's not there now.
Have they stopped gathering now?
Well, they've found different ways. They can go inside. So there's and I guess again that would then also speak to, well, not only ours but also Emmett's interest in terms of public space, and then trying to do something which, like, let's be blunt about it, was kind of fun, but was also, testing ideas, working with, working with reflection, working with color, but also working with how will this space be used, and will it be used as how we intended. And we've received lots of shots back from that it has been. It was quite successful, that people would just gather there and just offer something different. And it's a threshold space. So it's a threshold space into a cultural center. So it's also their part of, their generosity back to Carlo as well. So.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting idea. You mentioned TikTok earlier, and I was wondering whether that is a because the idea of the commons in the face of the digital and the emergence of the digital world, it's a very interesting one. Like, we've become more and more online, but your work also has that, and perhaps this relates in a way to your exhibition work and this intervention, say, for example, in Carlo and other works of a similar kind, where you are producing spaces, as it might be argued, maybe I should put it that way, it might be argued you're producing spaces which sort of facilitate the interaction between the digital world, between the TikTok video maker and the physical world, and trying to kind of mediate or curate that connectivity. Is that something that plays in your mind? Because I've actually heard someone say recently, a well-known architect say recently, that buildings need their Instagrammable moment. Like, you have to, as an architect, now design the building and then go, and we'll do a little bit of fab here so that, I don't know, an influencer can hashtag us.
God, that was laced with cynicism. I mean,
I don't know, is it?
how do I even begin to unpack that? No, I mean, yeah, I think that is one of the, it's clearly one of the key metrics about how we review things. I'm far too old and conservative to be on TikTok, but I am on Instagram, and actually came to it quite late, and then quickly realized that actually it's in, yeah, the visual nature of architecture and the types of details and the types of images is fascinating. But
Yeah, there's a whole other conversation.
that's a whole other conversation that actually I'm not qualified to discuss. In terms of the digital and the Instagrammable space, but I mean they're also just spaces as well. So I think there's a correlation between amazing areas to be in and enjoy, and taking a selfie of yourself. So it's not necessarily a strategy that's employed, but it does happen, to suggest that it doesn't, it's not something that is thought about when you're actually documenting progress on site yourself with your camera. That doesn't cross your mind, would obviously, that's not the truth. You're cognizant that this is something that will register, and this is how people will experience. And also, it's also how the majority of people may potentially experience something that is made, because they may not always have always the ability to get to the place. But as part of your design strategy, No, I think that's a secondary element. I think that's just another, it's another way of determining the success, actually. If people want to sort of, they're in something that a group of you have put together in terms of trying to design, understand, and then they've put themselves in that. That's kind of glorious, isn't it? And that's also the appropriation of architecture. That's like the public interface. That's what you want. That's what you're interested in. That's something that can be shared. There's something quite equitable and democratic about that, and people luxuriating in whatever that is. So, but as a strategy, no. But as an outcome, sure. You'll take what comes.
Take what comes. The you were working, you returned to the Venice Biennale this year, in a slightly
Many.
different role.
Yes.
That's also a virtual environment. I mean, obviously, for architects, I think Calvino's Invisible Cities is sort of a bit of a lodestar, but it's the whole enterprise of the Architecture Biennale at Venice is likewise a sort of a space of virtual value. Most people don't go. We all know about it. Most people don't go, can't afford to go, or don't have the means in one way or another. What was your role particularly this year? And perhaps we can sort of unpack some of those ideas around the function of the Biennale and thinking back about what happened this year and what it was good for, what it did, what it was trying to do. And I don't know.
Okay,
So you were an assistant curator?
so I was on the curatorial team, and I guess I should yeah I'm gonna I'll give the background, right? Because that's kind of more fun, right? So Leslie Loco was appointed curator the Venice Biennale. Leslie would have had old friend that she would have teached with in the past would be Professor Hugh Camp from UCD. And Hugh reached out to Leslie when she got appointed and said, "You're going to need a team." So Leslie's in that, she had just set up the AFI, African Futures Institute, in Accra. Leslie operates in slightly different parameters than the typical, I suppose, appointed curators. That it was her, it was an institution that was in its infancy. When doing a project like this, you need a team. And Hugh had suggested some people that had worked with Grafton in 2018. So out of those conversations, Emmett Scanlon, now appointed director, Irish Architecture Foundation, and Alice Clancy, architect and curator photographer. And then I was invited to join this team. I hadn't worked with Grafton in 2018, but I had considerable experience in Venice Biennale and also exhibition design. So my role on the team was that of exhibition design, but ultimately, we worked across everything. So there was also Sarah de Villiers, who's a South African architect, and Fred Schwartz, graphic designer, and then other people that were assisting us with that. Working with Leslie to sort of put the show together, work with participants, understand the spatial connectivity between the various participants, put together the infrastructure in place that working with Leslie on those curator elements. So there was a number of those throughout the sites, and then putting something that people could visit in May of this year. So that was the role. It was kind of it was stepping away from AP&E for a period, and then also stepping away from Queen's for a period. They were very generous in that, but then also it also connects with the type of work that we're doing, ongoing from that. So that was kind of the role. It was really a really really interesting project to work on, as I said earlier. So we've a long working relationship with Emmett. It was great to work with Leslie. Leslie's incredible communicator. Very generous and very aware of the type of exhibition and the type of Biennale that she wanted, and then working with her to sort of distill those ideas and translate those ideas, and then working with her colleagues both in the AFI and Ghana, and I should also point out the AFI research team as well, and then colleagues in the Biennale to to deliver that. So that was the role. What was most, well, there's lots of elements that are very striking. I know we'll probably loop back to the curatorial element after this, but in terms of day-to-day spatial design, architecture, all that sort of stuff, the bits that we were looking at were, so every year there's, as you know, there's the Art Biennale, architecture. There's always a lot of stuff built. We were trying to be as lightweight with resources as possible. And so it was an adaptive reuse exhibition effectively. So particularly down the corridory, there was a lot of, from the previous art show, the Cecilia Almani 2022 art show, there was a lot of plasterboard walls. So 5-6 meter tall plasterboard walls. And what we were interested in doing was retaining as much of that as possible, but then adjusting it. So working with lighting, working with sound, working with linings, making subtle incisions within that plasterboard. So changing the direction, riffing effectively on the curatorial strategy in terms of duality and different stories and bringing people through the space quite differently. And but holding on to that and then working also with color to try and create a sequence of and a rhythm down a very, very long building and a corner at the end. And offering spaces to for process things or take things on different boards. So we worked really hard in terms of introducing diagonals, introducing interruptions, resting spaces. So it's not a, it wasn't a trade show. So doing that in that particular space, and then also then with the Central Pavilion, we were working with on the front of the building, working with the graphic designer Fred, and Leslie's curatorial strategy, where she wanted shade at that point through the portico spaces. And then the idea of all the participants in the Central Pavilion and the idea of sharing spaces, and those conversations that emerge out of that. And then right in the center of the building, the idea of loom, where momentarily all the participants in the show were gathered in that particular installation. So it was those types of elements that spatially were a reflection on the curatorial strategy. And yeah. We were working.
So the theme was the laboratory of the future. What was that? This, I take it, was Leslie Loco's theme. What was the overriding idea behind? Like, what does that mean?
Well, you know, you need to get Leslie on to talk about that.
From your perspective, what did that?
From my perspective, Yeah, so to respond to that, I mean, this is without question. This was a biennale about African architects and diasporic architects around the world, and I mean, the quote that keeps going around that I see everywhere that the biennale kindly made posters of was the idea that the story of architecture is therefore incomplete, not wrong, but incomplete. So it's trying to frame it in a slightly different way and incorporate different voices and different representation. Mm-hmm. But then also, I guess the bit that connects with how we operate connects with the idea of what practicing as an architect means and the different ways that can practice and broadening that and not narrowing that. So there are many different ways of handling space, whether there's something actually happens or whether anything happens. And then there's many different ways of talking about that. So, so for us, just to be clear, we were not participants. You know, we were enabling participants. We were, mm-hmm. we were effectively ghosts in this operation, which was our role. And it's we were ensuring that those many, many different ways of understanding and describing architecture. Get an opportunity to be shown and discussed. And honestly, there's something from my personal experience, there's something really interesting about that, because it is an old institution. There's a grandiose sense about it. Even Venice as a term is kind of exciting. So when we were showing chippers in towns in Ireland in 2018 and their mosaic tile work, and we put it in a book, but it was in Venice for 6 months, suddenly something about that makes it, people sort of perk up and take notice that there's something special about that. So I think Venice has that ability in many different ways, whether it's from, you know, practitioners that are very early in their career and they get an opportunity to show their work to, you know, I think the numbers are nearly, you know, 300,000 people would have walked past and engaged with their work over those 6 months. That's the potency, and that's kind of the power. And that's, I guess that's not digital. Elements can be digital, but that actually critically isn't digital. And that is the dilemma, right? That is the dilemma, that it's, whereas to those who don't go, it does stay in that digital capacity. But to those who do go, they take those different elements from it because they're, you know, effectively up close and personal and in that space, and, you know, hearing those sounds or watching those films or looking at the work in a completely different way. And that's the potency of it. That's the power.
It's a critical device, isn't it, the Biennale? And it's a way of kind of, as you say, you know, reflecting on this incomplete story of architecture, this incomplete story of modernity in architecture, or what, modernism, or whatever it is. And that has been questioned, I mean, quite notoriously by Patrick Schumacher in a wild Facebook post, in which he sort of, I suppose, decried, might be one way of putting it, what he saw as the lack of architecture there. Now, I assume you wouldn't see that as a legitimate critique, but rather that there, this idea of architecture as we have it is too narrow.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to speak to the legitimacy of it as a critique or not, but I think it does speak to a limited understanding of what we're actually doing. So if I'm not mistaken, I mean, you know, that certainly, that got a lot of traction on a number of WhatsApp groups that I'm on at the time. So it was speaking particularly about the German pavilion and the idea of demolition, I remember at the time, there was something about that. So I guess the idea of separating architecture from what went before, and one is architecture and one isn't, I'm not convinced by that. I think it's all falls under the boundary of architecture. I think the idea of it becoming a rather, I don't know, rather tedious culture war is something I'm not particularly interested in. I think if we're not curious about these different devices that are done by non-architects but are clearly spatial or understanding spatial in a different way. I'm obviously clearly very supportive of that kind of discourse. I think there's a serious bang of old man shouting at cloud about it. So it's to try and reduce it to that when there is so much work and so many different positions on show. I think that's obviously, I would radically disagree with that. I think there's so much more on offer there in terms of how we view things and how we as architects, how we continue to not necessarily find relevancy, but how we continue to operate, because we're not going to just be rebuilding things from here on to eternity. If that's proven anything, is that we need to find different ways of understanding what our role are over, you know, if it's just around the parameters of, you know, professional practice and contracts and providing a service to clients, then I'm not really sure we're offering a whole lot more. So yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that position at all. And I would always urge, and it's something I'm sure you have similar conversations with students, you always urge that curiosity, right? That's really what's most important about it. Because even in my, for me emerging from college, which is less than 20 years ago, and then to the type of stuff I'm doing now, there's been serious, I wouldn't even say pivots, but there's been constant iterations. in terms of defining the type of work that, well, I do, or the type of work that we do as a practice. And I know that that will change again. There's different ways of viewing it. So if you're just stuck to one particular metric, then yeah, that's, I think that's particularly helpful. And I don't think it opens up the discourse. And that is also what I would argue is critical about things like the Venice Biennale. So you can talk about how it's, you know, it's not everyone gets to see it, and maybe there's a certain type of voice that, you know, traditionally emerges from it. But actually, it's the bringing people together and it's having those conversations, and it's seeing new things. That's really what's it's for. So it's to sort of that perpetual education of not just architects, but everyone. So I've been obviously back repeatedly, and you go from, there's the heady days of the vernissage, but actually it's the months of September and October and November are kind of glorious in Venice, where it's full of, you know, completely different demographics. So non-architects, school groups, you know, community groups from all over Italy, all over Southern Europe, and they're going to see different types of things that are sort of ensuring that the conversations are different. It's not necessarily about looking at pretty models of shapely buildings that are going to be built. It's it's all of those other things that talk about the spaces that we share across the globe.
I suppose my interpretation of Schumacher's and similar criticisms has always been that the claims made about what Venice does are so often enough so large. And I think that's quite an interesting reflection in terms of the way that you've talked about, for example, your work in Irish towns or your work as in master planning, community-led work, commoning and so on, where there is a kind of focus on the not the marginalized voice so much as just the unamplified or the quiet voice in the production of built space, which then in Venice is turned into a kind of carnival in a way. And the carnival requires, a good carnival requires, what's the word? Not soup. Yeah, enormous overamplification, a sort of surrealness that comes from that. And I suppose that's where that criticism comes from, is that Venice looks, you know, it looks hubristic, perhaps, to the outside world, where, you know, a small intervention is described as, and I speak from personal experience, described as doing things that...
it's clearly not.
Couldn't, because architecture can't.
Exactly. But the show isn't, the Laboratory of the Future is not didactic. I don't think it's necessarily solution based. I don't think it's a panacea. It's not suggesting that architectural fix all.
No.
But it is opening up the conversation, and it is it's not initiating, it's carrying on.
Yeah.
Other elements around that. And it's also grouping these things in a place, and it's particular grouping, you know. For that time, and I'm sure it'll go in different ways in the future. But it's also elements, I don't know, for me, particular projects like that, there's a time factor that has to be sort of carried in. So things will happen over the next 10, 15, 20 years that will emerge out of that. And they won't be just as a result of that, but they will kind of, conversations will have initiated and started there. They're ongoing.
Is it like the haute couture? Is it like Paris Fashion Week of architecture, you know, where, you know, Prada or whatever, like they put on absolutely wild costumes and you think, well, what the hell? And then 5 years down the line in Henny's or H&M, they've got a t-shirt with some hint. is that what it is? It's not a fashion show, is it?
No, it's not a fashion show. But I think if what you're describing is ideas and how they permeate, I think it's part of that globally in terms of enabling voices and enabling conversations and different voices and different types of conversations and platforming those and giving them space, and you can see that.
Yeah, for sure. So if you were to make a prediction, and this seems a little bit harsh, but if you were to make a prediction about what might be the critical themes that would draw, that you might, not all of them, but maybe one or two, that you would draw out of the experience of the Biennale of 23? What would you think were the things that Loco's work might point to?
Well, the term agents of change was used a lot in describing the exhibition. And that would have been part of the strategy across, you know, across Guests in the Future, across Force Majeure, and particularly across Dangerous Liaison. So it's where those with a spatial, I guess, a spatial understanding or a spatial position, whether they're trained architects or not, and how they're operating and how that is broadening. So it's this notion of stay in your lane about architecture, I find incredibly tedious and quite outdated, just to be very clear, quite explicit about it. So it's that. So it's like it's enabling different types of practitioners and showing. So I went there with students. So we had the luxury of going there with 150 students from Queens in Belfast in their second week. So some of the students had studied for architecture for a year at that point. And then just watching the different types of work that they were, of the participants that they were drawn to and then returned to and then discussed and talked about and whether they liked it or didn't like it or advocated for. That, I think, as an experience, really potentially sticks with you. So at that particular time when you're kind of still trying to understand I'm still trying to understand what type of architect I want to be. But at that particular point when you're in your early 20s, getting that type of exposure and then having those conversations with your contemporaries and your colleagues, I think that's really invaluable, actually, because that then forms a whole different trajectory of where you might go or where you might want to go or where you know you don't want to go, and really helps shapes you as you go forward. So I guess that's kind of essential, actually. Because it makes you be understand that from the earliest point in whatever you do, but in this case, architecture, you got to be reflective and you got to be cognizant of why you're doing something.
That is a good point to finish on. Lawrence, thank you very much. That was wonderful.
That was great crack. I enjoyed that immensely, Angus.
Good crack indeed. Thanks to Lawrence for the conversation and his patience too. There was quite a gap between recording and releasing here. See the podcast description for links to Lawrence's professional and social profiles. And thanks for listening.